This is Liquidity Talks, a live stream and podcast series designed to share the latest trends and updates from the world of treasury, liquidity, and risk. Join us as we power up the liquidity conversation.
Hello, and welcome to our latest installment of Liquidity Talks live stream and podcast. I'm Neville Roberts, founder and CEO of Planix, the market-leading fintech focused on treasury, liquidity, and risk. Our topic today is entitled Real-Time Liquidity's Impact on Non-Bank Financial Institutions. I'm joined today by our guest speaker, Chris Hess from Hesmer Partners. Chris, would you like to introduce yourself, tell us who you are, and what you do?
Absolutely, have. So I've been a consultant executive in asset management, wealth, pensions, investments for more years than I care to remember. But over that time, I've been lucky enough to work with some of the leading players in the sector, big asset managers like BlackRock, GSAM, Barclays Wealth, hedge funds like Man Group and Brevan Howard, and latterly more large insurance pensions firms like Zurich and Scottish Widows. Well, I started on this strategy and quant end of things over the years. I've increasingly been focused on the operations and systems that support them. It's probably actually why I found this topic so interesting.
Great. Well, thanks for joining us today. And because I've asked everyone else this, any football allegiances at all? Any interest in that?
Yeah, I got to admit, probably less than most. Football for me in the last couple of days has been about my American football team that's just gotten through to the next round. So Detroit Lions, if anybody's a fan, all the way to the Super Bowl anyway. That's unfortunately my football focus.
No, that's fine. That's football played with the hand, right? But that's not going to do that, right?
Football played with hands, yes.
Exactly. Right. So let's get into the topic today. So it's interesting. Previously, we've discussed and focused mainly on the banks or the sell side. And liquidity always seems to have been a word associated with banks. But I think the gilt crisis raised in many people's minds, this may not just be on the bank side. So a good place to start, and I think for the audience in general today, but what do we mean? And you want to explain what we mean by non-bank financial institutions. I think it's quite a broad term.
Yeah, no, absolutely not. In fact, non-bank financial institutions probably don't think of themselves as non-bank financial institutions. What we're really talking about here is the big insurers, the investment pension funds, and the asset and hedge fund managers that actually manage them. I think it's an important sector to think about because it's become more and more important to the global financial system over the last number of years. According to the FSB, the Financial Stability Board, it's gone from about 42% of global financial assets to over 50% as of 2022. In number terms, that's $230 trillion in 2022 compared to bank assets of about 171. So it's a pretty sizable portion of the financial sector. It's also been growing at a higher rate than other areas. It's been growing at about 7% over that period per year compared to about 4% for the banking sector. I think the other thing to consider when you're looking at non-bank financial institutions is how highly connected it is to the rest of the wider economy. We'll talk about the connections to the financial sector in detail a little bit, but across the wider economy, it's incredibly massive. The stuff you'd expect, your pensions, your savings, your insurance products, you know, they're also the major funding agent for virtually everything from investments in companies that produce the goods and services we use, government debt to fund public services, through to, you know, private investments in infrastructure, bridges, roads, tunnels, and the utilities that we use as well. The list is really endless, and the connections are extraordinary.
Got it. So look, it's quite a broad church, right? So there's just so many different types of institutions in this category. Do they all look at liquidity the same? Do they have the same view, or do they have different views on it?
Yeah, it's a good question, actually. At the highest level, it's pretty much all the same. It's having the resources available. You need them to meet your obligations. Other similarity is sort of in the traditional corporate treasury space, managing cash to fund day-to-day operations and that sort of thing. But it's in the core operations of each of these subgroups that you kind of see that they're looking at liquidity with slightly different lenses. The first lens is duration. Pension funds and life insurers tend to look at things over a much longer period of time. And this has actually led to a focus on what we call solvency at the expense of liquidity. So meeting your requirements over your short term. What this has really meant in practice is that it gets a lot less attention by executives and regulators. And of course, therefore, a lot less operational focus and investment. So that's the first lens. In the fund arena, we also see a slightly different lens. And this is kind of a strange one to think about, but liquidity isn't really just about meeting obligations, for instance, redemptions when they happen. It's also about meeting those redemptions, those obligations in a way that doesn't unfairly impact those that are either redeeming or investing. So when you have a fund that's made up of increasingly private and liquid assets, it becomes quite difficult to do, to really balance both sides of that. And that's a key part of that liquidity equation. But in essence, it still is about meeting those obligations when they need to happen.
Got it. So look, I mean, what happened in 2008, what happened last year with SVB Bank and so on, I think we understand them more now. But the gilt crisis, that took us by surprise. What happened? What was it? What caused it? Just give us your view on what happened during that time.
Yeah, without going into a 50-page academic treatise, I guess everybody will probably remember this hitting the news. It's a major market event in the UK that, while it impacted the market as a whole, it had a pretty very significant impact in the pensions world, particularly on a select group of very, very large pension funds that employed something that's called liability-driven investment strategies. Now, before we get into the mechanics of that crisis, it's actually worth noting that this wasn't the first time in very recent memory that we saw a shock like this. Back in the beginning of the pandemic, March 2020, we also saw a very, very similar, what I call a scramble. But back to the crisis. In brief, we had the now infamous mini budget announcements. Markets clearly didn't like that. They responded. We saw the pound and UK government debt plummet. The falling markets led to collateral calls. And these very large funds that were employing the LDI strategies became an amplifier to the crisis. They were forced to rapidly liquidate gilts in exchange for cash. These selling pressures led to a rapid evaporation of the gilt market. Essentially, there was no liquidity in the market to speak of. Equally, those that were able to pledge gilts as collateral, so the value of their collateral rapidly declined. And again, this just exacerbated the spiral. So it was the old death spiral sort of scenario. Now, I described it as a scramble earlier, as that's exactly what it seemed to be. It was a scramble to determine collateral eligibility. It's a scramble to find eligible collateral in uncertain inventories, a scramble to understand how much cash is needed, and of course, a scramble to convert those assets to of a very uncertain and movable inventory into cash. So it was an absolute mess. And then, as we remember, a few days later, the Bank of England had to step in to shore up the markets. To in effect prevent the failure of these largest UK pension funds, which would have had just incredible financial and social impacts.
So it sounds like a real mess. And I'm just wondering, how did we reach this point? So did things, apart from the political change, did anything happen previously? Was it just a growth of these firms? What ended up, why did we end up in this mess?
Yeah, there have been since then. There have been a ton of studies on the whole thing. So they've looked at it from a variety of different angles. So won't be able to go into all the detail, but of course, happy to share any that I found particularly useful. But I thought one of the really interesting things to look at was to understand how both the investment strategies evolved over time, and the related investment operations and risk management capabilities over that same period. First thing is to remember where we started. Historically, the strategies employed were relatively conservative, reasonably straightforward. The strategies focused on domestic debt, conservative equities, cash and cash equivalents. Nothing incredibly complicated. Minimal hedging requirements, and really only a modest use of derivatives. Liquidity was relatively unconstrained, or very unconstrained. And the operational focus was on cash management and very simple, reasonably low velocity trade processing, investment accounting. But over time, these strategies became a lot more complex for a variety of reasons. This led to a situation where we had much more complex portfolios, complex international exposures, liquid investments, complex correlations, valuations, and of course, the required hedging involved. This led to a situation where there were much more robust operational requirements, much higher volumes and velocity, and much higher derivatives usage. And for the first time, really, we had constrained liquidity due to the use of the focus on these illiquid investments and the heavy use of derivatives. Essentially, what we had was a situation where we went from a very traditional asset manager environment to what's really a complex hedge fund. And in many cases, again, not talking for all, the operations and risk management just didn't keep up with the requirements of that strategy.
Got it. And was it a UK thing, or is everything global these days? So even if it emanates from the UK, does it spread everywhere and infect everywhere?
Yeah, so this was reasonably UK focused. There were ramifications elsewhere. And there actually have been quite a few studies on this, because LDI strategies aren't something that are unique to the UK. But we had a perfect storm of the use of gilts, the issues that happened with the government, and a whole bunch of other factors. So it absolutely is something that can happen other places. We just, I think, we're a useful test case for how bad it could get.
A unique set of circumstances that we created to impact the whole of the world, right?
So help the world understand the vulnerabilities. I like to look at it as a public service.
Yeah, public service. So I mean, I remember where the SVB thing happened. It affected everywhere. So it wasn't just in the US. It infected everywhere. I had the issue with Credit Suisse, and it just spread. So people's view on risk and liquidity it did change. Okay, so look, we've heard noises as well coming out. Some of our clients are our NBFIs. We hear increasingly more about liquidity needs and risk needs from that sector as well. But a question I always ask, we're always talking about what happened. Very rarely do we talk about what could happen or the future. So that's the regulator's role to a certain extent. Where are they in this? What role have they played? Have they played enough of a role in this sector of the industry? Should they do more? And give us some commentary on that, if you could, Chris.
Absolutely. It's. I mean, one of the challenges in the sector is actually the range of regulators that oversee it or oversee various parts of it. As well, actually, an interesting point is the relative focus of those regulators and the relative capabilities of the regulators. So, for instance, if you have a pensions regulator, they're not necessarily going to be as adept at understanding markets requirements. So that's another sort of interesting piece. But that being said, I can't say that the regulators were asleep at the wheel for the whole time. There have been increasing calls over the years for much, much greater focus on this. At the global level, the FSB has been focusing on it since 2013 or so. More recently, the Bank of International Settlements has called for a more systematic approach of the sector. And in the UK, the Bank of England came out with their commentary on the crisis last March with some, I think, some very positive recommendations. This was followed up then by the FCA and the pensions regulator in April. So again, there's lots of different moving pieces here that you need to keep in mind, which is really the challenge, because to build a properly systematic approach, you need to coordinate across all of the local and global regulators, none of which have full authority or capability to do that. But you also need to have the resilience at the local level, the local firm level, to make sure that they're operating as well as the whole systematic environment. So it's a pretty complicated picture. But I think the good thing is that people are starting to look at it. In the UK, for example, the Bank of England has just launched what they're calling the system-wide exploratory scenario, which is looking to understand this market-wide dynamic. And it's really a first globally, which should be really interesting to follow over the next year or so.
Got it. And from a regulatory point of view, when we look at banks, the Basel III outputs pretty much were incorporated in BCBS 248. And if we look at Fed, PRA, Milo Swimmer, pretty much similar reports are required. But when we look at NBFIs and all the regulators you talked about, is the variety of outputs and what a NBFI has to create, are they a lot more varied by region than they are under the banking rules?
Yeah, very varied by regulator, by region. It's that lack of a sort of a coordinated approach, which to be honest, would be very, very, very difficult to do. So when you're thinking of you know, Basel or 2-3, whatever, you know, that's a discrete set of the market. There are probably less firms that you have to look at. They're usually larger, more sort of monolithic. It's much more varied when you look at the NBFI sector. So it'd be quite complicated for them to do. But you know, again, as you see from the numbers, increasingly important that they do. I'm hoping that this Swiss scenario gives them the ability to look at the commonality and therefore be able to build this, you know, more systematic approach to things.
So Swiss, you know, sounds like the regulators are actually putting the components in place to have a framework to actually analyze this. Is there a timeline on that? What are the outputs of that? What's the
the
outcome of that exercise?
So it was launched back in June of last year. Just to understand the dynamics of the banks and non-banks during market scenarios. They're launching a geopolitical stress with a series of rounds that will test how the different market operators are interacting. In the UK, there's over 50 participants, includes banks, insurers, and the funds managed by asset managers, hedge funds, and pension funds. We're currently in round one of the scenario phase. So we just launched November of last year with round two, which is sort of a next iteration of the crisis coming up in Q2. They should conclude and report back by quarter four of this year. So really hoping to see some useful information coming out of that. In terms of the... I'll just say in terms of the things that it's looking at, it's really looking at the interaction of liquidity, demand, and supply across the participants, but then also the willingness to intermediate during times of stress. Now, I fully accept that in a test scenario, an academic scenario that's for information gathering purposes, we might not get the full honest answer, but hoping that it does point us in the right direction.
Got it. And I know from talking earlier with you, you've done your own exercise to look at capabilities across this sector. Is that a fast track to the analysis that the Swiss is going to do?
I'd love to say it was that comprehensive, but I guess just in terms of this Swiss, I think it will highlight some of the stuff we already know. The scarcity and liquidity that's exacerbated by the reduction in willingness and all of that sort of stuff. But I am hoping that it highlights some of the stuff that we saw, which was the frictional issues that inevitably pop up in times of stress and some of the unexpected sort of conclusions. The work that we did, we looked at banks, hedge funds, asset managers, insurers, pension funds to look at the relative capabilities across the sectors, and we found that some of the sectors, namely pensions and insurance, just didn't have the robustness of operations or technology to act with the speed that was needed. That it's that scramble that I was talking about. Interestingly, it's something the FPC picked up on in their comments back in March. So I'm hoping that some of that comes up so that we have a chance to really bottom out what needs to be done.
Got it. And, what we've seen happen in the past, eventual crisis happens. Regulator comes in, reviews, recommends things. But have you seen any changes since the crisis in terms of these firms changing their practices or reacting or doing things in a different way? Or are they waiting for some outputs first?
Yeah, no, it varies across the industry, of course, but definitely getting a lot more attention at the board and executive level. And of course, from the regulators, which I'm not sure which comes first, but we're definitely seeing a lot more attention at that level, which is a real step forward. Because I think in the past it was second fiddle to solvency or anything else that was sort of on the cards. We've also seen sort of increases in liquidity buffers acquired and chosen to increase resilience. But I think the longer term issues is that addressing these core operational issues and infrastructural issues are just going to take a lot of time. This is addressing the core skills and capabilities that the controls and MI in place, the data technology use of automation. I think there's a start, but it's definitely not where it needs to be.
Got it. And look, a lot of industry observers and experts in this whole area said that the next crisis, when it probably comes, not if, will probably not be in the banking arena. It'll be in the non-bank financial institution area. So do you believe that? Do you buy that? Do you think that's where it's going to happen? And it's because they're like 5 years behind this process that we've been through in the banks?
Yeah, I mean, I hope not, but I think it's probable. The rigor that's gone into the banking sector, the learnings that we had from the global financial crisis, are really starting to bed in. It's been a number of years; they're starting to bed in. We have a lot longer to go on the NBFI side, and it's a more complex environment, I think. So the more attention we can pay to the area. And the more that firms can do to build their resilience and agility, the better I think will be, and hopefully then don't have to face into that. Because as we said right in the beginning, this is a sector that's intertwined with everything that we do. To some extent, banking was a bit removed from people's day-to-day lives. NBFIs aren't. We've heard about issues with utilities, that are funded by NBFIs. There's issues with funding our pensions, failures in insurers. Those are the things that will really hit us quite dramatically when if they ever did.
Yeah, and often, Chris, we have to wait for the crisis to happen for firms to react. So we saw that in the banking industry, but trying to get ahead of the ball here, if a crisis happens, as an impetus or a business case to then react. And unfortunately, that's the way the world works. So hopefully we won't have to go all the way through to a real problem first. It'll come first. So got it. And look, I often hear that quite a lot of these roles and tasks are outsourced. So if they're outsourced, where does the change need to happen? Is it systems, process? Is it people? Is it attitude towards this? What's your view?
I mean, it's, I guess it's important to understand that in this sector, again, lots of different pieces, views to the sector, but there are a ton of different operating models in place with outsourced asset managers, outsourced managers of managers, and various permutations of investment operations outsourcing, and it's often done for really valid reasons. I'm actually been involved in quite a few of these programs and overseeing a few outsourced functions, but. But the firms, the trustees, they need to remember that while it can improve capabilities and efficiency, it also adds that extra layer of operational risk to the whole equation, and they're still responsible for it. There's no way to get around that. So they really need that that big picture view and proper control and MI across that entire value chain. And again, we saw some of that during the last crisis, that there were exposed gaps, I guess, along the value chain. And it's really important that those things start to work through.
Got it. Look, certainly from what we've seen from the banking side, the need to evolve, it's often being driven by regulations or by internal audits and functions like that. But clearly, whether you're a bank or an NBFI, there's benefits to changing anyway. So what's your thoughts on not just the regulatory angle of this, but the benefits per se to moving to having a higher, better view on liquidity and its use and its risk?
Yeah. I mean, I actually think that's probably the most exciting part of it. Just doing regulatory purposes is one thing, but with it's almost a business case that writes itself. With more robust operations, firms can, they can grow faster, they can grow more safely, and they can do it all at a lower unit cost. If you don't have the control in place and the systems in place, your costs are exponential. You also get better returns on your portfolios. You don't have to hold liquidity as a just in case. You can optimize that, so there's no drag on the returns, and you have the resources to react to market movements, to react to the next crisis, but also in a positive way to take advantage of situations. And I think probably most importantly, because the sort of core value proposition in the industry is trust. You have the confidence that regardless of the situation, your investors, your policyholders, your customers will be able to trust that you have the situation in hand and you're not scrambling to try to find the way forward. So I'm hoping that that's the business case people use rather than just waiting for a regulatory stick.
No, I've got it. But I think it's really about the kind of the move to more real time. So there's a move to T+1 settlement in the US. What's your view on that coming over to Europe? And also in general, and this is our view, that the move to more real time or real time is really important. So when we talked to banks 8 years ago or so, T+1 was kind of about right, but now it's real time. I need to react within minutes at the very most. So what's your view in terms of how that drive is happening in this industry sector, and do you see it coming to Europe with T+1 and the move to real time?
Yeah, again, a really interesting question. To be honest, I had heard some resistance previously, but more recently, one of the big industry bodies has actually come out in favor of it. I think sees it as just a hygiene factor to being competitive with the rest of the world. I kind of tend to agree that we expect real time in everything else we do. Why wouldn't we expect that from the people that are managing our futures, managing our investments, managing our pensions? If I can get that in my own bank account, why the heck can somebody that's managing 230 trillion pounds? I think it's going to move to being just a hygiene factor, something a difficult one for people to get to, mind you, given I have seen some slower, I suppose, response times in days rather than minutes, weeks in some cases. I am definitely hopeful that people move very rapidly towards that and accept the changes that are coming in the rest of the global market.
Well, when I spoke to a large European bank, I think it was about 2013, they did a lot of this work in Excel, and it took them about 6 weeks to get. And the liquidity view of today is a little bit late, but obviously everything's accelerated from there now. So I think one of the barriers here is technology, and the world's still moving from batch-oriented platforms to real-time, and you can't just switch over and say we were batch, or I run a batch 2 times a day and I'm real-time. The architecture changes, need a real-time architecture to make that happen. So I'm sure if you speak to any bank or NBFI, they'll say sure, and any industry actually, real-time information is great, I want to react like this, but ultimately you need systems change and architectural change to make that happen. Great. Any closing remarks, Chris?
I think we've covered it, but it's been great to talk about this.
No, absolutely. My name is Neville Roberts. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye. Thanks, Chris.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Liquidity Talks. Don't forget to subscribe to stay updated on the latest developments and industry opinion from the world of treasury, liquidity, and risk.